This is Audible.
HarperCollins presents Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance by Alex Hutchinson. Foreword by Malcolm Gladwell. Read by Robert G. Slade. Foreword by Malcolm Gladwell. All distance runners have races that, in retrospect, make no sense. I have two. The first came when I was 13, in my first year of high school. With no more than a month of training under my belt, I ran a cross-country race in Cambridge, Ontario, against boys 2 years older than me. One of them was among the best distance runners for his age in the province. I can summon the memories of that race even today, 40 years later. I simply attached myself to the leaders at the beginning and never let go, and ran myself to complete exhaustion, finishing a close and utterly inexplicable second. I say inexplicable because, although I would go on to have a creditable career as a middle-distance runner on the track in high school, that race remains the only truly superb distance race I've ever run. I've underperformed at anything over 1,500 meters for the rest of my running life. That is, with one exception. 2 years ago, at the age of 51, I ran a magical 5K in a small-town race in New Jersey, finishing a full minute faster than any 5K I'd entered since returning to serious running as a master. On that summer day in New Jersey, I was suddenly my 13-year-old self from 40 years ago in Cambridge. I dreamt big. I marveled at my running prowess. And then, back to mediocrity again. Like the obsessive person, and particularly obsessive runner, that I am, I have puzzled endlessly over those two anomalous races. I have running logs from my teenage years, and I've gone back over them looking for clues. Was there some indication in my earliest training of that kind of performance? Did I do something special? For my latter 5K, of course, I have infinitely more months of data from Garmin on every workout leading up to the event, and then still more from the day of the race itself, pace, cadence, splits. On more than one occasion leading up to a race, I've attempted to replicate the exact preparation I had for my New Jersey PR. I wanted lightning to strike twice. It hasn't. And I'm beginning to suspect the reason it hasn't is that I don't properly understand what it means to perform a feat of endurance. I think you can see where I'm going with this. I am the perfect audience for Alex Hutchinson's Endure. A few words about Alex Hutchinson. We are both Canadians and both runners, although he is both a better Canadian, he still lives there, I don't, and a much better runner than I ever was. He invited me once to a tempo run he does with his friends on Saturday mornings in a cemetery in North Toronto. As I recall, I finished last, or maybe second last, since one of his running crew very sweetly condescended to run at my pace. Alex disappeared from sight after the first bend. As you will discover, Alex writes about the mysteries of endurance as a student of the science, a sports fan, and a keen observer of human performance, but also as a participant. He has his own anomalous races to explain. It must be stressed, though, that this is not a running book. There are plenty of running books out there, and as a runner, I have read many of them. But they are insiders' accounts written for other insiders, whether or not a runner should forefoot or heel strike or aim for a cadence of 180 strides per minute is a question only of significance to runners whose self-involvement extends all the way to the soles of their feet. But one of the many pleasures of Endure is how convincingly Hutchinson broadens the stakes. In one of my favorite passages from the chapter on pain, Hutchinson writes of the attempt by Jens Voigt to break cycling's one-hour record. Voigt was famously indifferent to pain, but when he climbed off his bike after breaking the record, Hutchinson tells us he was in agony. The pain he'd been pushing to the margins of his consciousness came crashing down. That is a cycling story. But in Hutchinson's hands, it also becomes a way of asking a much deeper and more consequential question about how our physiology interacts with our psychology. In a wide variety of human activity, achievement is not possible without discomfort. So, what is our relationship to that pain? How do the signals of protest from our brain interact with the physical will to keep moving? You don't have to be a maniacal cyclist to appreciate that discussion. If anything, that discussion is likely to dissuade you from ever becoming a maniacal cyclist. Everything was aching, Voigt said. My neck ached from holding my head low in that aerodynamic position. My elbows hurt from holding my upper body in that position. My lungs hurt after burning and screaming for oxygen for so long. My heart hurt from the constant pounding. My back was on fire. And then there was my butt. I was really and truly in a world of pain. Oh, man. It was painful just to read that passage. Does endure solve the puzzle of the anomalous race? In one sense, yes. My problem, I now realize, is that I tried to make sense of those performances using an absurdly simple model of endurance. The time I ran was my output, and so I worked backward and tried to identify the corresponding inputs that must have made it possible. Did I take one day of rest beforehand or two? How quick was that hill workout the week before? Is there something to be learned from the last set of intervals I did? The data that we gather from our GPS sports watches makes this kind of thinking even more seductive. It encourages us to paint a simple picture of how and why our body moves through the world. After you've listened to Endure, I promise you, you'll never settle for the simple picture again. There are many things Garmin cannot tell you. And luckily, for those many things, we have Alex Hutchinson. Endure. 2 hours, May 6th, 2017. The broadcast booth at the Autodromo Nazionale Monza, a historic Formula One racetrack nestled in the woodlands of a former royal park northeast of Milan, Italy, is a small concrete island suspended in the air over the roadway. From this rarefied vantage point, I'm trying to offer thoughtful guest commentary to a live-streaming audience of an estimated 13 million people around the world, many of whom have rousted themselves out of bed in the middle of the night to watch. But I'm getting antsy. The race beneath me is hurtling toward a conclusion that almost no one, through months of speculation and spirited debate, had considered possible. Eliud Kipchoge, the reigning Olympic marathon champion, has been circling the racetrack for an hour and 40 minutes behind an exquisitely choreographed formation of runners blocking the wind for him. And, remarkably, he's still on pace to run under 2 hours for 26.2 miles. Given that the world marathon record is 2 hours, 2 minutes, 57 seconds, and given that records are usually shaved down in hard-fought seconds, Kipchoge's performance is already straining the limits of my ability to convey surprise and awe. Giant screens in front of me are flashing detailed statistics about Kipchoge's run, but my mind is drifting away from punditry. I want to slip out of the booth and get back down to the side of the track, to feel the crackling tension in the assembled crowd, to hear the rasp of Kipchoge's breath as he runs past, and to look into his eyes as he pushes deeper into the unknown. In 1991, Michael Joyner, an ex-collegiate runner from the University of Arizona who was completing a medical residency at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, proposed a provocative thought experiment. The limits of endurance running, according to physiologists, could be quantified with three parameters: Aerobic capacity, also known as VO2 max, which is analogous to the size of a car's engine. Running economy, which is an efficiency measure like gas mileage. And lactate threshold, which dictates how much of your engine's power you can sustain for long periods of time. Researchers had measured these quantities in many elite runners who tended to have very good values in all three parameters and exceptional values in one or two. What would happen, Joyner wondered, if a single runner happened to have exceptional, but humanly possible, values in all three parameters? His calculations suggested that this runner would be able to complete a marathon in 1 hour, 57 minutes, 58 seconds. The reactions to his paper, which was published in the Journal of Applied Physiology, were mostly quizzical. A lot of people scratched their heads, Joyner recalls. The world record at the time, after all, was 2 hours, 6 minutes, 50 seconds, which the Ethiopian runner Bilene Densamo had run in 1988. A sub-2-hour marathon was not on anyone's radar. In fact, when Joyner first presented his ideas in the mid-1980s, the idea was considered so preposterous that his paper was initially rejected for publication. But the seemingly outrageous time was not a prediction, Joyner emphasized. It was a challenge to his fellow scientists. In some ways, his calculation was the apotheosis of a century's worth of attempts to quantify the outer limits of human endurance. This is how fast a human can run, the equation said. So what explained the chasm between theory and reality? Was it simply a question of waiting for the perfect runner to be born or the perfect race to be run? Or was something missing from our understanding of endurance? Time passed. In 1999, the Moroccan runner Khalid Kanouchi became the first person to dip below 2 hours and 6 minutes. 4 years later, Paul Turgot of Kenya breached 2 hours, 5 minutes. 5 years after that, Haile Gebrselassie of Ethiopia broke 2 hours, 4 minutes. By 2011, when Joyner and two colleagues published an updated paper in the Journal of Applied Physiology titled The 2-Hour Marathon, Who and When, the idea no longer seemed ridiculous. In fact, the journal published an unprecedented 38 responses from other researchers, speculating on the various factors that might bring the barrier closer. In late 2014, shortly after Dennis Kimeto of Kenya posted the first sub-2 hours and 3 minutes, a consortium led by a British sports scientist named Yanis Pitsilatis announced plans to break the 2-hour barrier within 5 years. Still, 2 minutes and 57 seconds remained a substantial gap. Also in 2014, Runner's World magazine asked me to undertake a comprehensive analysis of the physiological, psychological, and environmental factors that would need to come together for someone to run a 2-hour marathon. After reviewing mountains of data and consulting experts around the world, including Joyner, I presented 10 pages of charts, graphs, maps, and arguments, concluding with my own prediction. The barrier would fall, I wrote, in 2075. That prediction leapt immediately to mind in October 2016 when I got an unexpected call from David Willey, then the editor-in-chief of Runner's World. Nike, the biggest sports brand in the world, was preparing to unveil a top-secret project that aimed to deliver a sub-2 marathon in just 6 months. We were being offered the opportunity to go behind the scenes to cover the initiative, which they dubbed Breaking 2. I didn't know whether to laugh or roll my eyes, but I couldn't say no. I agreed to fly to Nike's headquarters in the Portland, Oregon suburb of Beaverton a few weeks later to hear their pitch. If someone had to debunk an overhyped marketing exercise, I figured the research for my earlier Runner's World piece had left me as well-equipped as anyone. As my guest spot on the television broadcast wraps up, Kipchoge hits 23 miles. It's May 6th, 2017, exactly 63 years to the day after Roger Bannister ran the first sub-4-minute mile. I'm nearly frantic to get trackside now, but I'm not sure how to get down from my lofty perch in the broadcast booth. Peering over the edge, I briefly contemplate swinging myself over the railing and risking the drop, but a stern glance from a nearby security guard dissuades me. Instead, I head back over the causeway that connects the broadcast booth to the main building's multi-story maze of dead-end hallways and unlabeled doors. I don't have time to wait for a guide. I break into a run. Part 1. Mind and Muscle. Chapter 1. The Unforgiving Minute. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. Rudyard Kipling. On a frigid Saturday night in the university town of Sherbrooke, Quebec, in February 1996, I was pondering yet again one of the great enigmas of endurance. John Landy. The stocky Australian is one of the most famous bridesmaids in sport, the second man in history to run a sub-4-minute mile. In the spring of 1954, after years of concerted effort, centuries of timed races, millennia of evolution, Roger Bannister beat him to it by just 46 days. The enduring image of Landy, immortalized in countless posters and a larger-than-life bronze statue in Vancouver, British Columbia, comes from later that summer at the Empire Games, when the world's only 4-minute milers clashed head-to-head for the first and only time. Having led the entire race, Landy glanced over his left shoulder as he entered the final straightaway, just as Bannister edged past on his right. That split-second tableau of defeat confirmed him as, in the words of a British newspaper headline, the quintessential nearly man. But Landy's enigma isn't that he wasn't quite good enough, it's that he clearly was. In pursuit of the record, he had run 4 minutes 2 seconds on 6 different occasions and eventually declared, "Frankly, I think the 4-minute mile is beyond my capabilities. 2 seconds may not sound much, but to me it's like trying to break through a brick wall." Then, less than 2 months after Bannister blazed the trail, Landy ran 3 minutes 57.9 seconds. His official mark in the record books is 3 minutes 58 seconds, since times were rounded to the nearest fifth of a second in that era. Cleaving almost 4 seconds off his previous best and finishing 15 yards ahead of 4-minute pace, a puzzlingly rapid and bittersweet transformation. Like many milers before me and since, I was a Bannister disciple, with a creased and nearly memorized copy of his autobiography in permanent residence on my bedside table. But in that winter of 1996, I was seeing more and more Landy when I looked in the mirror. Since the age of 15, I'd been pursuing my own lesser 4-minute barrier for 1,500 meters, a race that's about 17 seconds shorter than a mile. I ran 4 minutes 2 seconds in high school, and then, like Landy, hit a wall, running similar times again and again over the next 4 years. Now, as a 20-year-old junior at McGill University, I was starting to face the possibility that I'd squeezed out every second my body had to offer. During the long bus ride from Montreal to Sherbrooke, where my teammates and I were headed for a meaningless early-season race on one of the slowest tracks in Canada, I remember staring out the window into the swirling snow and wondering if my long-sought moment of Landy-esque transformation would ever arrive. The story we'd heard, possibly apocryphal, was that the job of designing the Sherbrooke indoor track had been assigned to the university's engineering department as a student project. Tasked with calculating the optimal angles for a 200-meter track, they'd plugged in numbers corresponding to the centripetal acceleration experienced by world-class 200-meter sprinters, forgetting the key fact that some people might want to run more than one lap at a time. The result was more like a cycling velodrome than a running track, with banks so steep that even most sprinters couldn't run in the outside lanes without tumbling inward. For middle-distance runners like me, even the inside lane was ankle-breakingly awkward. Races longer than a mile had to be held on the warm-up loop around the inside of the track. To break 4 minutes, I would need to execute a perfectly calibrated run, pacing each lap just 0.2 seconds faster than my best time of 4:01.7. Sherbrooke, with its amusement park track and an absence of good competition, was not the place for this supreme effort, I decided. Instead, I would run as easily as possible and save my energy for the following week. Then, in the race before mine, I watched my teammate, Tambra Dunn, sprint fearlessly to an enormous early lead in the women's 1500, click off lap after metronomic lap all alone, and finish with a scorching personal best time that qualified her for the National Collegiate Championships. Suddenly, my obsessive calculating and endless strategizing seemed ridiculous and overwrought. I was here to run a race. Why not just run as hard as I could? Reaching the limits of endurance is a concept that seems yawningly obvious, until you actually try to explain it. Had you asked me in 1996 what was holding me back from sub-4, I would have mumbled something about maximal heart rate, lung capacity, slow-twitch muscle fibers, lactic acid accumulation, and various other buzzwords I'd picked up from the running magazines I devoured. On closer examination, though, none of those explanations hold up. You can hit the wall with a heart rate well below max, modest lactate levels and muscles that still twitch on demand. To their frustration, physiologists have found that the will to endure can't be reliably tied to any single physiological variable. Part of the challenge is that endurance is a conceptual Swiss Army knife. It's what you need to finish a marathon. It's also what enables you to keep your sanity during a cross-country flight crammed into the economy cabin with a flock of angry toddlers. The use of the word endurance in the latter case may seem metaphorical, but the distinction between physical and psychological endurance is actually less clear-cut than it appears. Think of Ernest Shackleton's ill-fated Antarctic expedition and the crew's 2-year struggle for survival after their ship, the Endurance, was crushed in the ice in 1915. Was it the toddlers on a plane type of endurance that enabled them to persevere, or straightforward physical fortitude? Can you have one without the other? A suitably versatile definition that I like, borrowing from researcher Samuel Marcora, is that endurance is the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. That's actually Marcora's description of effort rather than endurance, a distinction we'll explore further in Chapter 4, but it captures both the physical and mental aspects of endurance. What's crucial is the need to override what your instincts are telling you to do. Slow down, back off, give up. And the sense of elapsed time. Taking a punch without flinching requires self-control, but endurance implies something more sustained, holding your finger in the flame long enough to feel the heat, filling the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run. The time that elapses can be seconds or it can be years. During the 2015 National Basketball Association playoffs, LeBron James's biggest foe was, with all due respect to Golden State defender Andre Iguodala, fatigue. He'd played 17,860 minutes in the preceding five seasons, more than 2,000 minutes ahead of anyone else in the league. In the semis, he surprisingly asked to be pulled from a game during a tense overtime period, changed his mind, drained a three-pointer followed by a running jumper with 12.8 seconds left to seal the victory, then collapsed to the floor in a widely memeified swoon after the buzzer. By game four of the finals, he could barely move. "I gassed out," he admitted, after being held scoreless in the final quarter. It's not that he was acutely out of breath. It was the steady drip of fatigue accumulating over days, weeks, and months that just as surely pushed James to the limits of his endurance. At the opposite end of the spectrum, even the greatest sprinters in the world fight against what John Smith, the coach of former 100-meter world record holder Maurice Greene, euphemistically calls the negative acceleration phase. The race may be over in 10 seconds, but most sprinters hit their top speed after 50 to 60 meters, sustain it briefly, then start to fade. Usain Bolt's ability to stride magisterially away from his competitors at the end of a race, a testament to his endurance. He's slowing down a little less or a little later than everyone else. In Bolt's 9.58-second world record race at the 2009 World Championships in Berlin, his last 20 meters was 0.05 of a second slower than the previous 20 meters, but he still extended his lead over the rest of the field. At the same World Championships, Bolt went on to set the 200-meter world record with a time of 19.19 seconds. A crucial detail, he ran the first half of the race in 9.92 seconds, an amazing time considering the 200 starts on a curve, but still slower than his 100-meter record. It's barely perceptible, but he was pacing himself, deliberately spreading his energy out to maximize his performance over the whole distance. This is why the psychology and physiology of endurance are inextricably linked. Any task lasting longer than a dozen or so seconds requires decisions, whether conscious or unconscious, on how hard to push and when. Even in repeated all-out weightlifting efforts, brief 5-second pulls that you'd think would be a pure measure of muscular force, studies have found that we can't avoid pacing ourselves. Your maximum force depends on how many reps you think you have left. This inescapable importance of pacing is why endurance athletes are obsessed with their splits. As John L. Parker, Jr. wrote in his cult running classic Once a runner is a miser, spending the pennies of his energy with great stinginess, constantly wanting to know how much he has spent and how much longer he will be expected to pay. He wants to be broke at precisely the moment he no longer needs his coin. In my race in Sherbrooke, I knew I needed to run each 200-meter lap in just under 32 seconds in order to break 4 minutes, and I had spent countless training hours learning the feel of this exact pace. So it was a shock and eye-widening physical jolt to my system to to hear the timekeeper call out as I completed my first circuit of the track, 27. The science of how we pace ourselves turns out to be surprisingly complex, as we'll see in later chapters. You judge what's sustainable based not only on how you feel, but on how that feeling compares to how you expected to feel at that point in the race. As I started my second lap, I had to reconcile two conflicting inputs. The intellectual knowledge that I had set off at a recklessly fast pace, and the subjective sense that I felt surprisingly, exhilaratingly good. I fought off the panicked urge to slow down and came through the second lap in 57 seconds, and still felt good. Now I knew for sure that something special was happening. As the race proceeded, I stopped paying attention to the split times. They were so far ahead of the 4-minute schedule I'd memorized that they no longer conveyed any useful information. I simply ran, hoping to reach the finish before the gravitational pull of reality reasserted its grip on my legs. I crossed the line in 3 minutes 52.7 seconds, a personal best by a full 9 seconds. In that one race, I'd improved more than my cumulative improvement since my first season of running 5 years earlier. Poring through my training logs, as I did that night and have many times since, revealed no hint of the breakthrough to come. My workouts suggested at most incremental gains compared to previous years. After the race, I debriefed with a teammate who had timed my lap splits for me. His watch told a very different story of the race. My first lap had taken 30 seconds, not 27. My second lap was 60, not 57. Perhaps the lap counter calling the splits at the finish had started his watch 3 seconds late. Or perhaps his effort to translate on the fly from French to English for my benefit had resulted in a delay of a few seconds. Either way, he'd misled me into believing that I was running faster than I really was, while feeling unaccountably good. As a result, I'd unshackled myself from my pre-race expectations and run a race nobody could have predicted. After Roger Bannister came the deluge. At least, that's how the story is often told. Typical of the genre is The Winning Mindset, a 2006 self-help book by Jim Brault and Kevin Seaman, which uses Bannister's 4-minute mile as a parable about the importance of self-belief. Within 1 year, 37 others did the same thing, they write. In the year after that, over 300 runners ran a mile in less than 4 minutes. Similar, larger-than-life, that is, utterly fictitious claims, are a staple in motivational seminars and across the web. Once Bannister showed the way, others suddenly brushed away their mental barriers and unlocked their true potential. As interest in the prospects of a sub-2-hour marathon heats up, this narrative crops up frequently as evidence that the new challenge, too, is primarily psychological. Skeptics, meanwhile, assert that belief has nothing to do with it, that humans in their current form are simply incapable of running that fast for that long. The debate, like its predecessor 6 decades ago, offers a compelling real-world testbed for exploring the various theories about endurance and human limits that scientists are currently investigating. But to draw any meaningful conclusions, it's important to get the facts right. For one thing, Landy was the only other person to join the sub-4 club within a year of Bannister's run, and just 4 others followed the next year. It wasn't until 1979, more than 20 years later, that Spanish star José Luis González became the 300th man to break the barrier. And there's more to Landy's sudden breakthrough after being stuck for so many races than simple mind over muscle. His six near misses all came at low-key meets in Australia where competition was sparse and weather often unfavorable. He finally embarked on a long voyage to Europe, where tracks were fast and competition plentiful, in the spring of 1954, only to discover just 3 days after he arrived that Bannister had already beaten him to the goal. In Helsinki, he had a pacer for the first time, a local runner who led the first lap and a half at a brisk pace. And more important, he had real competition. Chris Chataway, one of the two men who had paced Bannister's sub-4 run, was nipping at Landy's heels until partway through the final lap. It's not hard to believe that Landy would have broken four that day, even if Roger Bannister had never existed. Still, I can't entirely dismiss the mind's role, in no small part because of what happened in the wake of my own breakthrough. In my next attempt at the distance after Sherbrooke, I ran 3:49. In the race after that, I crossed the line as confused as I was exhilarated in 3:44, qualifying me for that summer's Olympic trials. In the space of three races, I'd somehow been transformed. The TV coverage of the 1996 trials is on YouTube, and as the camera lingers on me before the start of the 1500 final, I'm lined up next to Graham Hood, the Canadian record holder at the time, you can see that I'm still not quite sure how I got there. My eyes keep darting around in panic, as if I expect to glance down and discover that I'm still in my pajamas. I spent a lot of time over the next decade chasing further breakthroughs, with decidedly mixed results. Knowing or believing that your ultimate limits are all in your head doesn't make them any less real in the heat of a race, and it doesn't mean you can simply decide to change them. If anything, my head held me back as often as it pushed me forward during those years, to my frustration and befuddlement. It should be mathematical, is how U.S. Olympic runner Ian Dobson described the struggle to understand the ups and downs of his own performances. But it's not. I, too, kept searching for the formula, the one that would allow me to calculate once and for all my limits. If I knew that I had run as fast as my body was capable of, I reasoned, I'd be able to walk away from the sport with no regrets. At 28, after an ill-timed stress fracture in my sacrum 3 months before the 2004 Olympic trials, I finally decided to move on. I returned to school for a journalism degree and then started out as a general assignment reporter with a newspaper in Ottawa. But I found myself drawn back to the same lingering questions. Why wasn't it mathematical? What held me back from breaking four for so long? And what changed when I did? I left the newspaper and started writing as a freelancer about endurance sports, not so much about who won and who lost, but about why. I dug into the scientific literature and discovered that there was a vigorous and sometimes rancorous ongoing debate about those very questions. Physiologists spent most of the 20th century on an epic quest to understand how our bodies fatigue. They cut the hind legs off frogs and jolted the severed muscles with electricity until they stopped twitching. Lugged cumbersome lab equipment on expeditions to remote Andean peaks and pushed thousands of volunteers to exhaustion on treadmills, in heat chambers, and on every drug you can think of. What emerged was a mechanistic, almost mathematical, view of human limits. Like a car with a brick on its gas pedal. You go until the tank runs out of gas or the radiator boils over. Then you stop. But that's not the whole picture. With the rise of sophisticated techniques to measure and manipulate the brain, Researchers are finally getting a glimpse of what's happening in our neurons and synapses when we're pushed to our limits. It turns out that whether it's heat or cold, hunger or thirst, or muscles screaming with the supposed poison of lactic acid, what matters in many cases is how the brain interprets these distress signals. With new understanding of the brain's role come new and sometimes worrisome opportunities. At its Santa Monica, California headquarters, Red Bull has experimented with transcranial direct current stimulation, applying a jolt of electricity through electrodes to the brains of elite triathletes and cyclists seeking a competitive edge. The British military has funded studies of computer-based brain training protocols to enhance the endurance of its troops, with startling results. And even subliminal messages can help or hurt your endurance. A picture of a smiling face flashed in 16-millisecond bursts boosts cycling performance by 12% compared to frowning faces. Over the past decade, I've traveled to labs in Europe, South Africa, Australia, and across North America, and spoken to hundreds of scientists, coaches, and athletes who share my obsession with decoding the mysteries of endurance. I started out with the hunch that the brain would play a bigger role than generally acknowledged. That turned out to be true, but not in the simple "it's all in your head" manner of self-help books. Instead, brain and body are fundamentally intertwined, and to understand what defines your limits under any particular set of circumstances, you have to consider them both together. That's what the scientists, described in the following sections, have been doing. And the surprising results of their research suggest to me that when it comes to pushing our limits, we're just getting started. Chapter 2. The Human Machine. After 56 days of hard skiing, Henry Worsley glanced down at the digital display of his GPS and stopped. "That's it," he announced with a grin, driving a ski pole into the wind-packed snow. "We've made it." It was early evening on January 9th, 2009. 100 years to the day since British explorer Ernest Shackleton had planted a Union Jack in the name of King Edward VII at this precise location on the Antarctic Plateau, 88 degrees and 23 minutes south, 162 degrees east. In 1909, it was the farthest south any human had ever traveled, just 112 miles from the South Pole. Worsley, a gruff veteran of the British Special Air Service who had long idolized Shackleton, cried small tears of relief and joy behind his goggles for the first time since he was 10 years old. "My poor physical state accentuated my vulnerability," he later explained. Then he and his companions, Will Gow and Henry Adams, unfurled their tent and fired up the kettle. It was minus 31 degrees Fahrenheit. For Shackleton, 88 degrees 23 minutes south was a bitter disappointment. 6 years earlier, as a member of Robert Falcon Scott's Discovery Expedition, he'd been part of a three-man team that set a farthest south record of 82 degrees 17 minutes. But he had been sent home in disgrace after Scott claimed that his physical weakness had held the others back. Shackleton returned for the 1908-09 expedition, eager to vindicate himself by beating his former mentor to the pole. But his own four-man inland push was a struggle from the start. By the time Sox, the team's fourth and final Manchurian pony, disappeared into a crevasse on the Beardmore Glacier 6 weeks into the march, they were already on reduced rations and increasingly unlikely to reach their goal. Still, Shackleton decided to push onward as far as possible. Finally, on January 9th, he acknowledged the inevitable. "We have shot our bolt," he wrote in his diary. Homeward bound at last, whatever regrets may be, we have done our best. To Worsley, a century later, that moment epitomized Shackleton's worth as a leader. The decision to turn back, he argued, must be one of the greatest decisions taken in the whole annals of exploration. Worsley was a descendant of the skipper of Shackleton's ship in the Endurance Expedition. Gow was Shackleton's great-nephew by marriage, and Adams was the great-grandson of Shackleton's second-in-command on the 1909 trek. The three of them had decided to honor their forebears by retracing the 820-mile route without any outside help. They would then take care of unfinished ancestral business by continuing the last 112 miles to the South Pole, where they would be picked up by a twin otter and flown home. Shackleton, in contrast, had to turn around and walk the 820 miles back to his base camp, a return journey that, like most in the great age of exploration, turned into a desperate race against death. What were the limits that stalked Shackleton? It wasn't just beard freezingly cold. He and his men also climbed more than 10,000 feet above sea level, meaning that each icy breath provided only two-thirds as much oxygen as their bodies expected. With the early demise of their ponies, they were man-hauling sleds that had initially weighed as much as 500 pounds, putting continuous strain on their muscles. Studies of modern polar travelers suggest they were burning somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 calories per day, and doing it on half rations. By the end of their journey, they would have consumed close to a million calories over the course of four relentless months, similar to the totals of the subsequent Scott expedition of 1911-12. South African scientist Tim Noakes argues these two expeditions were the greatest human performances of sustained physical endurance of all time. Shackleton's understanding of these various factors was limited. He knew that he and his men needed to eat, of course, but beyond that, the inner workings of the human body remained shrouded in mystery. That was about to change, though. A few months before Shackleton's ship, the Nimrod, sailed toward Antarctica from the Isle of Wight in August 1907, researchers at the University of Cambridge published an account of their research on lactic acid, an apparent enemy of muscular endurance that would become intimately familiar to generations of athletes. While the modern view of lactic acid has changed dramatically in the century since then, for starters, what's found inside the body is actually lactate, a negatively charged ion, rather than lactic acid. The paper marked the beginning of a new era of investigation into human endurance, because if you understand how a machine works, you can calculate its ultimate limits. The 19th century Swedish chemist Jons Jakob Berzelius is now best remembered for devising the modern system of chemical notation, H2O and CO2 and so on. But he was also the first in 1807 to draw the connection between muscle fatigue and a recently discovered substance found in soured milk. Berzelius noticed that the muscles of hunted stags seemed to contain high levels of this lactic acid, and that the amount of acid depended on how close to exhaustion the animal had been driven before its death. To be fair to Berzelius, chemists were still almost a century away from figuring out what acids really were. We now know that lactate from muscle and blood, once extracted from the body, combines with protons to produce lactic acid. That's what Berzelius and his successors measured, which is why they believed that it was lactic acid rather than lactate that played a role in fatigue. For the remainder of the book, we'll refer to lactate, except in historical contexts. What the presence of lactic acid in the stag's muscles signified was unclear, given how little anyone knew about how muscles worked. At the time, Berzelius himself subscribed to the idea of a vital force that powered living things and existed outside the realm of ordinary chemistry. But vitalism was gradually being supplanted by mechanism, the idea that the human body is basically a machine, albeit a highly complex one, obeying the same basic laws as pendulums and steam engines. A series of 19th century experiments, often crude and sometimes bordering on comical, began to offer hints about what might power this machine. In 1865, for example, a pair of German scientists collected their own urine while hiking up the Faulhorn, an 8,000-foot peak in the Bernese Alps, then measured its nitrogen content to establish that protein alone couldn't supply all the energy needed for prolonged exertion. As such findings accumulated, they bolstered the once heretical view that human limits are, in the end, a simple matter of chemistry and math. These days, athletes can test their lactate levels with a quick pinprick during training sessions, and some companies now claim to be able to measure lactate in real time with sweat-analyzing adhesive patches. But even confirming the presence of lactic acid was a formidable challenge for early investigators. Berzelius, in his 1808 book, Forelastningar i Djurkemin, Lectures in Animal Chemistry, devotes 6 dense pages to his recipe for chopping fresh meat, squeezing it in a strong linen bag, cooking the extruded liquid, evaporating it, and subjecting it to various chemical reactions until, having precipitated out the dissolved lead and alcohols, you're left with a thick brown syrup and ultimately a lacquer, having all the character of lactic acid. Not surprisingly, subsequent attempts to follow this sort of procedure produced a jumble of ambiguous results that left everyone confused. That was still the situation in 1907, when Cambridge physiologists Frederick Hopkins and Walter Fletcher took on the problem. "It is notorious," they wrote in the introduction to their paper, "that there is hardly any important fact concerning the lactic acid formation in muscle which, advanced by one observer, has not been contradicted by some other." Hopkins was a meticulous experimentalist who went on to acclaim as the co-discoverer of vitamins, for which he won a Nobel Prize. Fletcher was an accomplished runner who, as a student in the 1890s, was among the first to complete the 320-meter circuit around the courtyard of Cambridge's Trinity College while its ancient clock was striking 12, a challenge famously immortalized in the movie Chariots of Fire, though Fletcher reportedly cut the corners. Hopkins and Fletcher plunged the muscles they wanted to test into cold alcohol immediately after finishing whatever tests they wished to perform. This crucial advance kept levels of lactic acid more or less constant during the subsequent processing stages, which still involved grinding up the muscle with a mortar and pestle, and then measuring its acidity. Using this newly accurate technique, the two men investigated muscle fatigue by experimenting on frog legs hung in long chains of 10 to 15 pairs connected by zinc hooks. By applying electric current at one end of the chain, they could make all the legs contract at once. After 2 hours of intermittent contractions, the muscles would be totally exhausted and unable to produce even a feeble twitch. The results were clear. Exhausted muscles contained 3 times as much lactic acid as rested ones, seemingly confirming Berzelius's suspicion that it was a byproduct, or perhaps even a cause, of fatigue. And there was an additional twist. The amount of lactic acid decreased when the fatigued frog muscles were stored in oxygen, but increased when they were deprived of oxygen. At last, a recognizably modern picture of how muscles fatigue was coming into focus. And from this point on, new findings started to pile up rapidly. The importance of oxygen was confirmed the next year by Leonard Hill, a physiologist at the London Hospital Medical College, in the British Medical Journal. He administered pure oxygen to runners, swimmers, laborers, and horses, with seemingly astounding results. A marathon runner improved his best time over a trial distance of 3/4 of a mile by 38 seconds. A tram horse was able to climb a steep hill in 2 minutes and 8 seconds instead of 3.5 minutes, and it wasn't breathing hard at the top. One of Hill's colleagues even accompanied a long-distance swimmer named Jabez Wolfe on his attempt to become the second person to swim across the English Channel. After more than 13 hours of swimming, when he was about to give up, Wolf inhaled oxygen through a long rubber tube and was immediately rejuvenated. The sculls had to be again taken out and used to keep the boat up with the swimmer, Hill noted. Before, he and it had been drifting with the tide. Wolf, despite being slathered head to toe with whiskey and turpentine and having olive oil rubbed on his head, had to be pulled from the water an agonizing quarter mile from the French shore due to cold. He ultimately made 22 attempts at the channel crossing, all unsuccessful. As the mysteries of muscle contraction were gradually unraveled, an obvious question loomed. What were the ultimate limits? 19th century thinkers had debated the idea that a law of nature dictated each person's greatest potential physical capacities. Every living being has from its birth a limit of growth and development in all directions, beyond which it cannot possibly go by any amount of forcing. Scottish physician Thomas Clouston argued in 1883, the blacksmith's arm cannot grow beyond a certain limit. The cricketer's quickness cannot be increased beyond this inexorable point. But what was that point? It was a Cambridge protege of Fletcher, Archibald Vivian Hill, he hated his name, and was known to all as A.V., who in the 1920s made the first credible measurements of maximal endurance. You might think the best test of maximal endurance is fairly obvious. A race. But race performance depends on highly variable factors, like pacing. You may have the greatest endurance in the world, but if you're an incurable optimist who can't resist starting out at a sprint, or a coward who always sets off at a jog, your race times will never accurately reflect what you're physically capable of. You can strip away some of this variability by using a time-to-exhaustion test instead. How long can you run with the treadmill set at a certain speed? Or how long can you keep generating a certain power output on a stationary bike? And that is, in fact, how many research studies on endurance are now conducted. But this approach still has flaws. Most important, it depends on how motivated you are to push to your limits. It also depends on how well you slept last night, what you ate before the test, how comfortable your shoes are, and any number of other possible distractions and incentives. It's a test of your performance on that given day, not of your ultimate capacity to perform. In 1923, Hill and his colleague Hartley Lupton, then based at the University of Manchester, published the first of a series of papers investigating what they initially called the maximal oxygen intake, a quantity now better known by its scientific shorthand, VO2 max. Modern scientists call it maximal oxygen uptake, since it's a measure of how much oxygen your muscles actually use rather than how much you breathe in. Hill had already shared a Nobel Prize the previous year for muscle physiology studies involving careful measurement of the heat produced by muscle contractions. He was a devoted runner, a habit shared by many of the physiologists we'll meet in subsequent chapters. For the experiments on oxygen use,